If we're going to control this beast that we set off, climate change, I just think we have to be ruthless and relentless in finding the economical costs. And the social cost of carbon, I think, is the key ingredient in helping guide us.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. What is the social cost of carbon? Or can it tell us about the effects of and the policies to mitigate climate change? In another of our podcasts in which we speak to the researchers who've been giving lectures as part of the BREAD ICG virtual PhD course in environmental economics, I'm speaking to Michael Greenstone of the University of Chicago about how we quantify the damages from climate change and how we might use the social cost of carbon to evaluate mitigation policies. Michael, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
First of all, Michael, you described in your lecture the social cost of carbon, SCC, as the most important number you've never heard of. So can you explain what it is and why it is so important as a number?
Sure. The social cost of carbon is a measure of the economic damages associated with the release of an additional ton of CO2. And so just to put that in context, the average person in the U.S. is probably responsible for, let's call it 14 or 15 tons of CO2 per year. Mm-hmm. And it tells you the damages that each of those tons is bequeathing on our children and their children and on and on. And it turns it into monetary terms.
Why haven't more people heard of it? Does it matter if everyone hasn't heard of it?
Oh, well, the reason most people haven't heard of it is because, like, a lot of conversations with economists, talking about what we actually do is a terrific way to end conversations. So it's a terribly wonky statistic, but it's very, very useful because what governments are doing around the world to varying degrees is they're enacting policies that restrict emissions. Mm-hmm. And those policies have costs associated with them, and they can often be boiled down to the cost per ton of CO2. But you would only want to do those policies if the benefits exceeded the cost. Mm-hmm. And the social cost of carbon is giving you the benefits. So if you had a policy that costs $50 a ton per ton to abate it, and the SEC were $51, then you would be happy to do it. If it were $200, then you would be thrilled to do it.
We have been estimating the social cost of carbon for quite a few years now. Historically, how have we gone about doing this? What sort of numbers have we come up with?
When I was in the Obama administration, I had the idea after we had failed to pass a cap and trade program, the president had been clear that there should be option B. Because in that option B necessarily was going to be a regulatory approach. And to do regulations, you have to have an estimate of what the benefits would be, just as I explained a minute ago.
Yeah.
And I should just go backwards for a second. The reason that's so important is because if you have a fight or a battle or a competition between the cost of a policy and the benefits of policy, and the costs are in dollars and the benefits are in something called metric tons of CO2. Remember, I'm in the US, yeah. We're still very, very confused about metrics. And if you had that fight between the metric tons and the dollars are going to win every single time. So anyway, I had the idea and then co-led with my friend Cass Sunstein a process to set the U.S. government social cost of carbon. And when we did that back in 2009, we surveyed the literature, and it was largely based on what are called, this is also a totally great way to end conversation, integrated assessment models.
Which are right,
three
yes.
words that I think I know each of them, but most human beings do not know them in that particular order. One thing led to another. We summarized what they were trying to tell us. And I should mention, by the way, that the integrated assessment models were, we should credit Bill Nordhaus, who is a giant in the field in environmental economics and won the Nobel Prize. But when we added them all up by the end of the Obama administration, it was about $51 per ton of CO2. Mm-hmm. That was the social cost of carbon.
And you believe this now, we're going to go into this in a lot more detail, but generally speaking, you believe this to be, at this point, a massive underestimate.
Yeah, I think the challenge is that those integrated assessment models were largely built in the 1990s and early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And what happened in the interim was computers got really, really fast and we got access to all kinds of data. And it was no longer necessary to make reasonable seeming assumptions, you could actually use data to help understand what the cost of climate change should be. And I think we got a better sense of how to think about how to discount the damages avoided that happen far out into the future and several other things. Basically, climate science and economic science advance, and they had left, in my estimation, the integrated assessment models behind. And so there was a great opportunity to improve the credibility and pull the social cost of carbon up to the frontier of understanding. But at the end of the Obama administration, that was the right number in my view.
But of course, if you're still anchored at that number and the number should be higher, it means that you don't do things that you should be doing when it comes to mitigation and avoidance policies?
Yes, exactly. So I guess you're trying to build a narrative tension here, but so I'm just going to give it away. I now think that the right number is more than $200. There was a whole raft of policies that cost, let's say, between $50 and $200 per ton that were socially beneficial that would not be done if you continued to use the $51 per ton number. That's to say nothing of the interlude of American history where Donald Trump was the president and all pretense of using science and economics to set the social cost of carbon were tossed out the window and instead went with kind of political gut.
Let's look at how you get to that $200 number. How do you and your colleagues go about this estimation now?
The first thing we did is we said, hey, a lot of the things we've understood have been from very, very limited data sets. So for instance, what we understood about temperature and mortality was largely based on studies done in very rich, very temperate climates. Think of Northern Europe, think of parts of the United States. And in those places, higher temperatures increased winter temperatures, and that's beneficial. Really cold temperatures cause premature mortality. And the summers weren't very hot to begin with. They were projected to get a little bit hotter, and the two kind of balanced each other out. And from that, we assumed that the mortality effects of temperature increase would be zero for the world.
Yeah.
What we said, and the we is a co-founded a group called the Climate Impact Lab with my friends and colleagues, Solomon Chung, Trevor Hauser, and Bob Kopp. And we said, you know, not everybody lives in Sweden and not everybody lives in Chicago and not everyone lives in London. There's maybe like 6 or 7 other billion people on the planet. And why don't we collect data that is more reflective of the whole world? And what we found when we did that is that there's lots and lots of people who live at already hot places. And actually, a lot of them are not very rich by global standards. And for them, the increase in temperatures pushes people into very, very hot summers where they can't turn on cooling and do all kinds of things to protect themselves. And so we found a very, very large projected increase in mortality. And so that's just one example of the benefits of collecting data from the whole world and analyzing it with, let's say, more modern techniques.
Now, I note at the Climate Impact Lab, you are proudly multidisciplinary. As a number like this, you described it as wonky. It's exactly the sort of thing that I would imagine economists would do. How important is it to have the other disciplines involved?
Oh, absolutely critical. Bob Kopp is a quite accomplished climate scientist, and he's one of the co-founders. And now to dive into academic minutiae, it's every president of a university's dream that there be something called interdisciplinary work. And they periodically issue an order that there be more of it. It all sounds great, but it's really, really hard. And the reason is we build up our particular languages that make us effective at communicating with each other and make us almost unqualified to talk to people in other disciplines. And so we probably spent the first few years trying to break down those communication problems. But what emerged is that I think we can legitimately now say we're on the frontier of climate science. Bob was absolutely central to driving us there and to shedding light on what that meant for our approach. And I think it really makes for a much stronger effort. I should also mention the data we used was absolutely massive. And so having people with real data expertise and data science expertise on the team was equally instrumental.
Now, Now, Michael, when you talked about how this is used to evaluate policy, you said if it avoids $200 of the social cost of carbon and it costs $50, then of course you're delighted to do it. Is it really as simple as that to apply this to policy?
Well, it's simple on a blackboard. I think the idea that governments would slavishly follow cost-benefit analysis with their green eye shade on and do exactly what the numbers say is an affectation that is does not describe the real world as I've observed it. But what I will say is cost-benefit analysis is super useful for guiding policy. You know, there may be instances where it's desirable for other reasons to take on policies where the costs exceed the benefits. But if that gap gets too big, then I think people really start to begin to ask questions. And I think it can serve a very important role there. There's one other thing that I'd like to return to just on the totally sausage-making wonky side of things.
Yeah.
Another feature of what we did that was really important, I think, is everybody understands instinctively that knowing what the impacts of climate change will be is no one's going to be able to get a perfect answer there.
Yeah.
And there's lots of uncertainty around it. And there's uncertainty about what the economic damages would be, even for a given level of warming. And there's for a given level of emissions increase, there's uncertainty about what the temperature increase will be. And one thing that we spent a lot of time on is trying to characterize that uncertainty and bring that uncertainty into our analysis. And I'll just highlight that people don't like uncertain events. They would rather know that they were going to lose $50 from climate change than face a 50-50 gamble of losing zero versus 100. And so we're able to bring that into the analysis. And that's an important part of what we did as well. Sorry, we'll get back on... back on your plan.
So if you're using this to evaluate policy, what sort of cost-benefit analysis is it currently used for? Should it be used for more things?
Should economists be consulted for more things? Of course. The world would be better. There would be more ponies. There would be more unicorns, more rainbows. If people just listened to economists a little bit more, we would be richer, happier, healthier, wiser. What would be the benefits?
Yes. What would be the benefits if the social cost of carbon was used to figure into more policy decisions? What potential policy decisions would those be?
I'll tell you what the benefit would be. Look, why do I think this is so important? Fundamentally, people care about a lot of things. They care about the kind of food they eat. They care about going on vacation. Some of us really, really love watching professional basketball and want to care about buying the NBA league pass so I can see all of the NBA games, no matter how obscure, at any time of day or night. So I just think there's a limited amount of money that people are going to be willing to devote to confronting climate change. And if you accept that premise that we're not going to devote all resources to it, then it sure would be great if we could get as much carbon per dollar as possible. The analogy I use with my students all the time is if you could go to the store and they had identical tomatoes in two bins and one of them cost $10 and one of them cost $1,000, wouldn't it be nice if you could only pull the tomatoes out of the $10 bin? And so right now, without cost-benefit analysis, I think we're mitigating tons of CO2 at an unnecessarily high cost without something to guide us. If we're going to control this beast that we've set off, climate change, I just think we have to be ruthless and relentless in finding the economical costs, the economical tons of CO2. And the social cost of carbon, I think, is the key ingredient in helping guide us.
A couple of weeks ago, I spoke to your colleague, Tamar Carlton, and we were talking about how the damages from climate change are very different in very different places for very different people. If we're doing this kind of cost-benefit analysis and how this applies to policy, how do we think about this with regards to the social cost of carbon?
So Tamar is right about basically everything. What she is pointing to is that the projected damages from climate change from our estimates are highly unequal. And they're not just like randomly assigned around the world. They're pinpointed at places that are hot already and places that are poor already. And then the bullseye is places that are hot and poor. The example I like to use is we would feel very, very different about climate change if it was going to, say, reduce everyone's income by 1% around the world. Versus it killing 1% of people Now, if you looked at GDP, those two are the same thing, but we would care a lot more about the latter. And so we try to capture in our estimation of social cost of carbon that when damages are unequal, that's important. And when they're unequal and targeted at today's poor or the people who will be poor when the damages arrive, we might want to care more about them.
And should we be thinking more in some of those places as well about the sort of tipping points that we're beginning to see where those costs suddenly become much, much higher?
Yeah, I think the inequality of projected damages and the fact that climate change is not going to equally reduce everyone's income by a couple of percentage points unlocks a lot of, let's call them known unknowns, I guess, in the famous phrasing of Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
Will there be parts of Pakistan and parts of India and parts of Bangladesh where these are not island states, these are places where scores of millions of people live, where these places become largely uninhabitable? And how is the world going to handle that? Does that mean people are just going to move within the borders of those countries? Or will there be pressure for people to migrate across borders? And recent history does not suggest that countries are readily able to absorb large quantities of migrants. So that would be one example of what unequal impacts could unlock. This is, I would say, only tangentially related to what you're driving at, but I do think it's worth highlighting. One thing, we sure love our maps and our colors at the Climate Impact Lab, and we have these highly geographically resolved estimates. And what they show is that there's these regions of the world near the equator that are very red. Red is bad in our color taxonomy, where that means that there's going to be very large impacts, damages of climate change. Equally, there's large tracts of land that are going to be really blue. Those are, let's call them in Russia and northern Canada and places like that. You know, if we had a world in some kind of John Lennon view of the world, if we had a world without borders and everyone got along, an obvious thing would probably be for a bunch of people to migrate from the red to the blue. But the idea of even Canada, widely recognized as the friendliest set of people around, suddenly being willing to absorb several hundred million migrants, I think is far-fetched in the best case. And I'm pretty confident Vladimir Putin does not view that as part of his plan for restoring Mother Russia. So there's just going to be a lot of pressure put on the geopolitical system. It would take a wiser person than me to come up with precise probabilities on what the outcomes of that are going to be, but most of the ones I can think of are pretty bad.
Your arithmetic that is used to come to a social cost of carbon is inconvenient for policymakers because it's so much higher than any numbers that they have been using and implies they must be doing much more. Do you think that there is a good chance that they will come over to your way of thinking?
One thing that I've been very encouraged about is, at least with respect to the U.S. government, is that they set out to update the social cost of carbon. In fact, the National Academy of Sciences in the United States recommended that it be updated several years ago. Unfortunately, that report was released a day or two before President Trump was inaugurated. And so that report was ignored. But the Biden administration took up the mantle of that report, and they are in very advanced stages of adopting the estimates that we're producing and have indeed put them out as their proposed estimates, which they're taking public comment on. And I expect in the next several weeks, we'll make a final decision. Every wonk wakes up every morning and thinks, man, the world would be better if there were some evidence-based policymaking. I don't think that's how most human beings wake up, but every wonk wakes up that way. And I think this is an example of where at least the U.S. government seems on the track to doing exactly that.
What about outside the U.S., Michael? Because you're not really a wonk. You've lived in the policy world for a long time now. Are you encouraged that policymakers are grasping the problem?
Yeah, I think we're in a way better position than we were probably 5 or 10 years ago. And that's due to several things. One, we got lucky on the climate science seems to be breaking such that for a given increase in emissions, the range on temperatures now seems a little bit narrower on possible temperatures. The second way we got lucky is we've had very large, and some of this is policy driven, but some of it is luck, very large reductions in the costs of lower carbon or even zero carbon sources of energy. And I say the third way is the world has been muddling its way towards more stringent climate policy than certainly was true a decade ago. Is it increasing at the rate that is going to cut off all bad parts of climate change? Absolutely not. One other thing I'll just note, I'm obviously in the U.S., and so I don't want to overstate the U.S.'s role in the world, but the U.S. government's willingness to engage in the deep wonkiness of the social cost of carbon, there's not another government doing that. And a consequence of that is that the U.S. government number often becomes a focal point. And so you see other countries just plain adopt what the U.S. government has done. And so that's a way in which this can have broader impacts. And certainly several other countries have straight away adopted the U.S. number.
Well, let's hope those broader impacts come to pass. Michael, it's great talking to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So if you want to follow up on this, the Climate Impact Lab is at impactlab.org. And there's a paper called A Guide to Updating the US Government's Social Cost of Carbon. And the authors, you won't be surprised to hear, are Tamar Carlton and Michael Greenstone. That was published in the Review of Environmental Economics and Policy in 2022. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the papers we feature.